Defining organizational politics. Politics is the ideas and activities used by people within a particular group or try to get power. This is what Macmillan's dictionary says. So it's nothing but the ideas and the activities that are used by people within a particular group, whether it is to do a political group, whether it is to do with an organizational small team of project team, you know, to try to get the power. Okay, so there are numerous definitions of organizational politics. Mainly involves using, you know, power to impact decision making in an organization. It is an attempt to use power based towards influencing their goals, the criteria, or processes used for decision making. So basically, the entire power game is exercised more towards influencing people, influencing the goals, influencing the criteria or the processes used for making decisions. Existence of politics. How do you actually realize that politics exist in an organization? It is a widely understood fact that political behavior is a major part of an organization's life. So any organization that you work with, so when you join a corporate, you have to make an understanding to your own self that politics come as a part and parcel of this job. So many managers believe that some political behavior, as long as not detrimental to others, is considered ethical, and it's necessary also, because yes, as I mentioned to you, as I gave you my example, that I have got manipulated multiple times because of the fact that I did not possess those skills. And today, when the managers are making a selection, as long as it's not detrimental to others, it's not giving a problem to others, one should have the necessary level of political skills and behavior with them. So the reason being, organizations have individuals and groups with different values. So every organization, the whole organization and the different people in the organization bring in different values every day in and day out. And the interests are also varied. And the resources available in the organizations are limited. You have to work with those resources. We can't have the luxury of having a new resource every time just because the resource is political in nature, or the resource is not able to get along with me. I will now demand for another new one. I cannot have that luxury. So hence, the managers believe that it is fine to have some amount of political skills and behavior with them. So factors that influence political behavior. So these are some of the factors, individual factors, and these are your organizational factors, which leads into political behavior, low or high. And then you get the favorable outcomes. You get rewards, you get penalties as well. So individual factors are your high self-monitoring, internal locus of control, organizational investment, perceived job alternatives, expectations about your success. What are the organizational factors? Reallocation of resources, promotion opportunities, no trust among the managers, ambiguity in terms of the role, unclear performances. So these can lead into political behavior. This combination of both or one alone, one factor alone, can also lead into political behavior. Because you do not have, you have ambiguity about your role, because you do not have clear expectation about your performance, you do not have clarity as in when will you get promoted, you end up getting into political behavior, and then you become, either you get a reward or you get a penalty. The fact is that main reason for conflict over allocation of the limited resources, like, you know, budgets, your space, responsibilities, and salary increments. People may not view efforts or performance as sufficient to be considered good and warrant a resource allocation in others' favor. It does not happen like that. People may not view others' efforts. They only look at, everybody has a tendency to look at their own efforts, look at their own merits and own accomplishments. So nobody gives you in a platter. Okay? And an organization may be political, may be completely politic-free, only if all people share the same objectives. But unfortunately, it doesn't happen. Does everybody possess the same objectives and the interests? No, everybody has different interests. If organizational resources are abundant And if performance outcomes are free from subjectivity, then an organization may be politics free. Factors that contributes to political behavior. How does it trigger a political behavior in individuals within an organization? So there is a variation in the level of politics in the organization. Some could be very low, some could be moderate, and some could be very, very highly political. And I know some companies, which I cannot name the brand over here, they are very, very highly political in nature. And if you learn the tricks of the trade, you're able to survive in that organization. It is difficult for you to survive even 3 months. In some organizations, levels of politics is very, very high. And that's where you are. There's a question of survival. So this is so because the numerous factors that appear to encourage political behavior, because there are many reasons to be able to politically very high and encouragement of political behavior. So these factors may be arising from individual characteristics or be a result of organization's culture or internal environment. So the internal environment is such that it is leading into, it can arise from individual characteristics, or it could be a result of organization. The culture is like that. Hence, everybody who comes in gets influenced over a period of time and gets into political behavior. Because they've seen that, other than that, there's no other way of surviving. Certain individual and organizational factors can increase political behavior and provide favorable consequences. What are some of the individual factors? Personality traits. Some personality traits like, higher political behavior. These traits are high self-motivators, possess an internal locus of control. They're always power hungry, high need for power. The individual as investment in the organization, if high, less likely to use of illegitimate means. If the individual has not invested much in the organization, there is less likelihood of using illegal or illegitimate means there. Certain situations and cultures promote politics as well. So in case of what are such cultures? So in case of organizations decreasing resources, if your organization is downsizing constantly and your number of resources are going on the lower scale, people may resort to political behavior to save their portions. So to be able to save your own team member, you might get into politicizing the whole situation. I have been party to, and I have seen these happening in front of me as an experience I have gathered, that when the companies try to downsize, the managers would go helter-skelter. All this while, they never bothered as much to fight for the right of those people who works with them. But the moment the downsizing happens, they know that there'll be less number of people under their span of control. They go helter-skelter saving those employees. Okay, so this sometimes is looked at very selfish way of leadership, but that's how it is. Major changes, particularly those leading to reallocation of resources, lead to conflict and politicking as well. In case of opportunities of growth, politicking again may prevail. As if there are two people working in the same role and one is managing one particular business and another one is managing the Y business, and both are lateral to each other. Both are at par. But now there comes that there is a position which has existed, which has got opened up, which got vacated, and out of the two individuals, only one person will get that position. Okay, so and the opportunity, and then they can bring in one person to be able to fill the void which gets created there, which is already ready within. So now here the political, politicking situation might arise here. Who will get the torch? Okay, so that's where your political games will start. So cultures characterized by low trust, low ambiguity, unclear performance measurement systems, self-serving senior managers encourage political behavior largely. So when you have cultures where you do not have trust, you have everybody helter-skelter everywhere, there's no role clarity, there is no performance clarity, it's only about saving each other's back, it is only about self-serving, senior managers. You go and assist your manager, you go and give support to your manager, you are the best one in the world, okay, and you get all as you desire. So these kind of situations will, these kind of cultures will definitely encourage your political behavior. How do people respond to organizational politics? That's the big question. So very strong evidence indicates that perceptions of organizational politics are negatively related to job satisfaction. So the more the politics, lesser is the job satisfaction. It also tends to increase job anxiety and stress. The moment when you're constantly guarded and when you know that there is politics going around with regards to your role, you will be constantly at stress and anxiety levels. Possibly because people believe they may be losing ground to others. You might feel the threat because there's a new leadership which has come and the leader is comfortable having his own people around. So you might have to lose your ground to the new ones. So that could be another stress. It could be because they feel additional pressures from entering into and competing in the political arena. It could all kinds of threats may come and pose as a stress to you. So hence, people might respond very, very negatively to organizational politics. It may also lead to self-reported declines in employee performance because employees perceive political environments to be unfair. Because everybody believes that the environment has become very political in nature, it is very unfair to myself, and because of the environment, I am getting demotivated to put my best foot forward on my job. So surprisingly, when politicking becomes too much to handle, it can lead the employees to even quit. And I have seen so many people leaving organizations because of this. And they come from an organization, very good competition and all of that, with huge amounts of, you know, salary bargain. They must have come and joined the organization with a great expectation, but they can't even survive more than 3 months. And they resign from the job and sometimes go back to the same organization that they come from. Political behavior at work also moderates the effects of ethical leadership. It also curtails down the ethical leadership. So one study found that male employees were more responsive to ethical leadership compared to women. And most citizenship behavior with levels of both politics and ethical leadership were high. Women, on the other hand, appeared most likely to engage in citizenship behavior. So more than ethical behavior, women have an evidence of showing more responsiveness towards citizenship behavior when the environment is consistently ethical and apolitical. So when employees see politics as a threat, they often respond with a defensive behavior. They're always guarded. They're reactive and protective behaviors to avoid action, blame, or change. You know, those kind of things will happen. They will always do a blame game. They'll just blame shift, or they will just change from where they are. Defensive behaviors are also some of the associated with some feelings, like negative feelings towards the job. I do not like the job anymore. I don't like the job environment that I am into. Employees may find that defensiveness protects their self-interest, but in the long run, it will wear them down. So some people may find that right now, if I'm defending myself and protecting myself, it might just work for the time being. But however, in the long run, it may completely work against me. So people who consistently rely on defensiveness finds that it is the only way they know how to behave. And at that point, they will lose the trust and support of their peers, bosses, employees, and clients. This is what eventually happens for the people who are consistently thriving on defensiveness. In 1995, Hawker and Wilmot defined conflict as an expressed struggle, at least between two interdependent parties, who perceive incompatible goals, scarce resources, and interference from each other in achieving their goals. So this is what Wilmot and Hawker has defined conflict as, that it is a struggle between two interdependent parties who perceives that they have incompatible goals, they have limited resources with them, they have interference from each other, and these becomes an obstacle to achieve their goals. So this is what conflict is all about by Hocker and Wilmot. The most common idea about conflicts is that it is a perception, and if no one is aware of the conflict, then it can be said that the conflict does not even exist. So if no one is aware and the conflict is happening in the working in the superficial level, it is very, very intrinsic, and it is not being felt by people, then the conflict is considered to be not existing. Few typical type of conflicts people experience in organizations include incompatibility of goals, differences over interpretations of facts, disagreements based on behavioral expectations. So these are few typical type of conflicts that people experience in different organizations. So there are various, when you understand the process of conflict, there are various stages that you come across. The first stage is the potential opposition or the incompatibility. As we understood the incompatibility here, that there is the incompatibility amongst, because of which they are unable to, incompatibility of goals, differences over interpretation of the, they are not interpreting the facts rightfully, and there is a disagreement between the behavioral expectations. So what is the stage one of the conflict? The stage one is the potential opposition or the incompatibility. What is that incompatibility? Stage two is the cognition and personalization. So what is it that, how do you manipulate it, how do you identify it, and how do you personally relate to it? What are your intentions for this? So when you're identified, when you have understood the conflict, when there is a conflict arising, what are your intentions to do it? And what are the behaviors that are involved in it? So while you are in a conflicting situation between the two parties, you are not working well with each other, you are in a conflicting situation, what are the behavior that you are displaying? And what are the outcomes of this conflict? So when you talk about potential opposition or you talk about incompatibility, you talk about the antecedent conditions like communication. The communication is not, we are not having enough communication, we are not communicating rightly, the structure is poor, there are various personal variables that are involved with it. Stage two, there is a perceived conflict and there is a felt conflict. As I mentioned to you, depends on whether it is, the conflict is very, very perceived, which is just being is one-sided, and whether the conflict is felt or experienced. So intentions here, conflict handling intentions. So you can just correlate each one of this. Stage one, potential opposition, are this antecedent conditions that arise because of which, and cognition and your personalization, where you recognize whether it is a perceived conflict or is it a felt conflict. What are the intentions of handling this? Competing, we want to compete with each other, we want to collaborate together, we want to create a win-win situation. Compromise, or we want to avoid, or we want to accommodate. So these are the intention of handling the conflict. Now, why will I handle the conflict? I have to have one of the reasons, no? So behavior, what are the behaviors that you're displaying? Overt conflict, parties' behavior, others' reaction. Stage five, what are the outcomes of it? So when you do this, when you get into behavior like this, you increase group performance or you decrease group performance, right? Because of this conflict, your group performed so well, they became so cognizant about their own performance that their group performance improved, their efficiency improved, and or else they became so disparate from each other, they completely went aloof of their group of their outcome, and hence their group performance decreased. So as an organization, you need to encourage open discussions so that it bridges the gap of the differences in opinions that has arise. You have to lay emphasis on common interest on resolving conflict and avoid excessive entrenchment of individual viewpoints. Now comes to negotiation. Now, what are negotiations? Negotiations are formal discussions in which people or groups try to reach an agreement, especially in a business or political situation. So you negotiate together, there's a huge brainstorming session which happens, finally you come to a conclusion of a common agreement, which somewhat yours, somewhat the others come into existence. And you collaborate together to come to a common discussion, a common agreement. Negotiation is defined as a process that occurs when two or more parties decide how to allocate scarce resources. If you have very limited resources, scarce resources with you, when two parties, two or more parties discuss together to be able to utilize the scarce resources effectively is what negotiation happens. Bargaining. Now, what is bargaining? Bargaining is a simple form of the distributive negotiation process that is both competitive and also positional. So it is not really negotiation. It's basically lose some, gain some kind of a thing. Simple form which distributes the process of negotiation. So this includes labor management bargaining, managers negotiating with employees, you know, with regards to salary, with regards to targets, peers and supervisors, sales managers negotiating with customers, purchase department negotiating with vendors. All these are your bargaining. So the terms of bargaining, which can be interchangeably, it is used for negotiation. But these are typically, the activities includes these, you know, with negotiating with your employees, peers, and your supervisors, your sales managers, purchase managers, negotiating with the vendors. All these are your actually bargaining. So negotiation or bargaining strategies, what are the two general approaches to negotiation and they are different from each other in their focus, interest area, their goal and motivation, information sharing and duration of the relationship. So it all depends. So there are two approaches to it. First is your distributive bargaining or negotiation. Second is your integrative bargaining or negotiation. So they are both negotiation but used in different contexts. First is your distributive bargaining, second is your integrative bargaining. So in distributive bargaining, what happens is negotiation often means distribution dividing up the negotiating pie. So the procedure is known as distributing bargaining. So here this has been defined by Senner in 2008. Okay, so you distribute the means of negotiation, so you distribute the pie effectively. So for example, a woman goes into the market and negotiates with the fruit seller to reduce the price of mangoes per kilo. This is said to be engaging in a distributive bargaining. So he has a whole cart of mangoes. The woman has gone with an intention of buying mangoes, but she says that you reduce the price of a kilo. Whether I buy 1 kilo or whether I buy 2 kilos, doesn't matter. But per kilo, it's not that. Some people, what they say is that other ways of negotiation would be, you buy 3 kilos, I will give you at this much of a lump sum amount. So here, the woman goes and negotiates the fruit seller to reduce the price per kilo of mangoes. The gap, so what distributive bargaining is all about is that the gap between the target point and the resistance point is the aspiration range. And there's an overlap of both negotiating parties, aspiration range becomes the settlement range. So because you come to a settlement point in which both parties' aspirations can be met. Okay, so you both come down a bit and come to a common position where both your aspirations as a buyer and a seller, both aspirations are being met. Distributive bargaining tactics. What are the different ways and means of handling distributive bargaining? A key tactic in distributive bargaining is to be the first one to make an aggressive offer. So the one who is the first one to put that offer in place. It displays power on behalf of negotiator, and powerful individuals tend to make initial offers. Not everybody is ready to make an initial offer. They will just keep wait and watch a strategy in place. Okay, speak first at meetings and gain advantage. So extroverts do really well here. So you speak first at the meetings and gain the advantage during the bargaining process. So such anchors greatly favor the negotiator who sets them, right? So it displays power on behalf of the negotiator, and the person who put the offers first is actually the best negotiator. Okay, and extroverts do this job very, very well. Now comes your integrative bargaining. What do you mean by integrative bargaining? Integrative or cooperative, it is also called as cooperative bargaining. It is expanding the pie by negotiating for mutual gain and creating value to be shared by both negotiators. Guasco and Robinson in 2007 said this. So it's a type of bargaining, whereby you expand the pie by negotiating for mutual gain. You do a win-win. You come down, you probably stretch a little bit. The idea is to negotiate into a mutual gain that we both are winning, okay? And creating a value to be shared by both the negotiators. So you, the value that you have created in that mutual agreement is beneficial to both the negotiators. So integrative bargaining is about reaching a win-win situation in a negotiation where both parties are able to make optimal benefits. So both the parties are actually gaining something or the other, maybe superficially, or maybe just conceptually, but they have a feeling of win-win. Both the negotiator will have a feeling of win-win. So that's what is integrative bargaining all about. It also ensures that lesser gaining party, if is left feeling good about the negotiation process, over many occasions of negotiations between the two parties, it tends to become increasingly more cooperative in future negotiations. So if at all they feel that, you know, the person who was the negotiator ended up feeling good about the whole negotiation process. So for further also, whatever negotiations comes forth, in your business context, you will become more supportive in future, more cooperative in future. There are a few conditions that needs to be met while integrative bargaining is taking place. Okay, so transparency of information between both the parties, it has to be crystal clear. Nothing should be left hidden. Both the parties should be very, very clear of the objectives. Honest confession of issues and concerns. So you have to be very, very honest about if there is any drawback in the product that you're selling, or if you're if you see any kind of pitfall or any shortcomings, you need to, you know, any concerns with regarding to the product or the service that you're offering, you need to make it very, very clear and honest confession to the other party. You should be sensitive to each other's issue. Both the parties have to be sensitive and very concerned about each other's issues. So because then only you will develop that trust. High level of trust needs to be established. Willingness and maintain willingness to maintain a flexibility, that you cannot be rigid on one number. You have to be a little flexible enough in the whole process. Okay, various ways to ensure more integrative outcomes. Focusing on the underlying interest rather than on issues, as in such negotiations, the joint outcomes are much higher. Okay, so focus on the underlying interest, the not the stated needs as much, but the unstated needs, the unstated concerns that the negotiator would have. Avoid compromising, as it decreases the pressure on integrative bargaining. Because if one party gives in, you know, that creativity from the process disappears. If one party says that, okay, fine, you know, let's go ahead with this. Let's not discuss too much time. I do not have. So you completely move away from the whole concept of integrative bargaining, because he's just giving it up. He's not feeling a win-win at all. Okay. So if one party gives in, then creativity from the whole process disappears and both parties together may just settle into a lower total outcome of the negotiation. They just will settle down into a, you know, common ground. So there's no proper integrative bargaining which has happened. Now these are the differences between distributive negotiation and integrated negotiation. I will discuss a few points here. The involved parties keep information hidden here because of the objective being very, very clear. And a distributive negotiator will always have some information to themselves. An integrative negotiator will always have parties share information with each other as crystallized as possible, because both of them have to get to the root cause of the why of the existence of the issue. So they will have to understand why of the issue that they're negotiating. The aim of such negotiation is winning. Here, the aim of, like, I give you the example of the woman who was bargaining to reduce the cost of mangoes per kilo. So, idea of her negotiation is about winning. That I need to win, no matter what, even if it is by a cost of 2 rupees, I'm fine with that. But I'm winning, no, ultimately. So, integrative negotiation. The aim of this negotiation is making a wise decision, which is beneficial to both. The main focus of involved parties is on the stance or the position. Here, the main focus of the involved parties is on the goals and the objectives. So that's the difference between the two. Here, the focus is on the position. Here, the focus is on the objective. So preparation and planning for negotiation. So this step will involve gathering the information and building a strategy for negotiation basis the information that you have had. So keep a track of one goals. It needs to be documented. And as regards to negotiation affecting a relationship, we must weigh the pros and cons of both the processes of bargaining, whether you want to go towards distributive or the distributive or the integrative process. We would have to first iron it out and before getting into restraining of our relations. So hence, we need to be sure enough before embarking on it. So once you have gathered all your information, use it to develop your strategy. The definition of the ground rules now. Post preparation and planning, ground rules and procedures of the negotiation are to be set between the two parties who are involved. Finally, the parties exchange their initial proposals. You share your proposals, you share your approach notes or the demands and clarification and justifications, if any. The next step is of explanation, clarifications, justifications between the two parties, why we are choosing this, why we are doing this way, why we are taking this route regarding the original positions. It is advisable to provide each other with any possible documentation in your support. So if possible, please provide documentation as much as possible. Every step of yours, every action should be documented. This is the key step where the actual discussions takes place in order to reach a common ground, in order to reach a settlement stage. So here both the parties are expected to make concessions. So both the parties have to be slightly flexible enough. They have to make a slight concession. Closure and implementation. This is the final step in negotiation involving formalization of the settlement, reaching into plans for implementing and monitoring it. So in many cases, many times what happens, it may be just a formal handshake between the negotiators. It could be just a formal handshake saying that, okay, we can get going. And the proposal has been sent by the main negotiator to the receiver. It has been impact of individual differences on effectiveness of negotiation. It has been seen that some individuals are more effective negotiators than the others are, depending on the skill sets that they have. Most commonly, four factors impact the negotiation ability. The individual personality trait, as we mentioned, extroversion, introversion, and all of that. So individual personality trait will matter, moods and emotions of the negotiators, cultural differences that they have, and gender differences that have. So these are the four predominant factors that work, that impact the negotiation process. By personality trait, I mean, by knowing an individual personality, we may be able to predict about his or her negotiation style and tactics only to be limited extent, as because personality and negotiation outcomes are very weakly related. So by predicting his personality itself, we can, devise our plan accordingly. So if we know that the person is a person who is more of an introvert, we should definitely project ourselves in that way. We should not talk about too much across the world things. We do not talk about too much of external factors. Agreeable or extroverted individuals may not be very successful in distributive bargaining. Why? Because being outgoing and friendly tend to share more than required information. Because if you are very friendly, if you're very approachable and you're an extroversion person, you will be sharing too many information than is required. So hence, it will not be effective in case of a distributor because the secret will not be maintained. Okay, so hence, the distributive bargaining will not be very effective here. The impact of individual differences on effectiveness of negotiations, moods and emotions. So moods and emotions will play a vital role here. The impact of moods and emotions varies with type of the negotiations. In one hand, anger displayed by negotiators who are in a low power situation generates antagonistic outcomes. So the negotiator who's on the lower power stance will definitely have an antagonistic outcomes here. Anxiety also tends to have an effect on the negotiation. Hence, positive moods will trigger will lead to positive outcomes. In integrative negotiations, positive moods and emotions tend to lead to more integrative agreements, as positive mood is related to creativity. It is research says that if you are positive enough, you are able to think creatively. You are able to think out of the box. Cultural differences play again another role tend to affect the negotiation styles of people. In a study of the US and Japanese negotiator, it was found that conflict avoidant Japanese negotiators, they are not the ones who always likes to get into conflict. So the conflict avoidant Japanese negotiators tended to communicate indirectly and adapted behaviors to the situation. So they indirectly, they did not confront the situation, they communicated completely indirectly, having all pros and cons in place and adapted the behaviors as per the situation. Gender differences. The negotiation styles between men and women may not be different, but the outcomes of the negotiations are. The values placed on outcomes vary between men and women. Okay, so there is a huge difference between the values that you place on outcomes. Studies suggest that women tend to be less aggressive in negotiations as they tend to be concerned about the reprisal from others. They always want affiliation of others. They always look at the concerns of the people. Hence, they are not very hard negotiator. They're not very aggressive in negotiation. Another finding shows that women are more likely to engage in assertive negotiation when they are bargaining on behalf of someone else than for themselves. So when they are very cognizant when they are bargaining on someone else's behalf, they are more likely to be more assertive in ways and means because they do not want to get into a negative stance. They want to bring that, if they're doing something for the on behalf of somebody, they will make sure they are extraordinarily assertive. Third party negotiations. In a third party negotiation, there may be any of the three roles the party may play. The third party may play as a mediator, he might be an arbitrator, or he might be a conciliator. Now let's see what each of these means. So role of a mediator, what does he do? A neutral third party who enables a negotiated outcome with the help of logic and coaxing, recommending options as termed as mediators. So what they do is they do nothing, but they are just, so they just put the logic and the coax in place. Okay, and they suggest they recommend some options that, and they are used as, so they kind of expedite or maybe make the agreement more probable by adding their logics in place. That's how a third party is plays. That's what is a third party or a mediator's role. The role in detail, the given three situations here are influenced on the effectiveness of a mediator. For the mediator to be effective in bringing about a successful negotiation, the negotiator groups or individuals must be motivated to bargain and bring about a resolution. If they are not motivated enough, the mediator can't do anything about it. So there should be equal amount of enthusiasm between both the parties. Mediator will be effective in moderate to low intensity conflict. Hence, in case of high intensity conflict, mediation will not be very effective. So mediator will not be of no use if there is a high stakes in the high intensity conflict. If there are too much of change in opinion, too much of difference in opinion, too much of change in logic, there the mediator will not help. Perceptions of the mediator by the negotiator, negotiating parties are critical in determining the success of the mediator. So it's very critical, when the mediator perceives the kind of perception that is made made for the mediator by the negotiating parties. The way you look at your mediator will make a lot of difference, will be a critical point in determining the success of the whole negotiation. Now, what is an arbitrator? A third party possessing the authority to enforce an agreement between the negotiating parties is termed as an arbitrator. There are two types of arbitrations, voluntary and compulsory. So what is voluntary arbitration? Such an arbitration is requested by the negotiating parties. Negotiating parties only ask for an arbitration. Compulsory arbitration, it is enforced on the negotiating parties by law or contract. So by virtue of law, by virtue of the contract, the compulsory arbitration comes into place. One major point in the favor of arbitration is that it necessarily brings about a settlement between the conflicting parties. One favor of arbitration is that it definitely brings about a settlement. The end goal is always a settlement between the conflicting parties. No matter how stretched or how difficult it was, he will bring into a consensus and they will get into a mutual agreement. Now, the role of a conciliator. Now, what is a conciliator? A third party that is trusted and provides an informal communication link between the negotiating parties. It's just how a broker works, basically. So they just do an informal communication between the two parties. In terms of effectiveness, both conciliation and mediation are comparable. They are not different. Conciliators play a much larger role than just being communication link, as they also engage in fact-finding, understanding the messages, convincing both the parties in his own capacity. To build a consensus, the conciliators will speak to the negotiating parties differently if required. Okay, so in different situations, they would strike conversations and they will bring into a consensus. Thank you so much.